Tucson, Arizona with Professor Stanley Payne, emeritus professor in the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So Stan, where were you born?
I was born in the North Texas town of Denton in September 1934. That's just a few miles north of Dallas.
And what was your childhood like? Was it frontier childhood?
Perhaps you're not that old.
No, the Comanches were causing no trouble by that time. This was a childhood in what was then a small Texas town, though a county seat, coming out of the Depression, and so conditions were very modest. There was enough to eat, but of course luxuries did not exist in that kind of life. And in fact, in Texas, we did not even have an automobile. So it was a very modest childhood, and yet everything that was necessary was provided for. In fact, we were able to live in our own house, though a rented house, for the last 3 years. My father was ruined by the Depression, but found work as a carpenter because he was always very good at working with his hands, and we'd never had that kind of employment ever before. So he kept food on the table. And we lived in Texas down to 1944, which was the time when we began the part to form for the Great Migration to California.
Okay. So you actually didn't have a car as a when you were a child. How did you get around? I
mean, in a county seat with a population of 12,000, things were concentrated in the center of town, and you walked everywhere. Really had to walk very far. I don't think anyone ever walked, say, 8 or 10 blocks in one direction or the other, because things were so concentrated in this small town.
So when your father, when he did carpentry jobs, he basically worked for the neighbors, for people he probably knew, or...
No, he worked for the main construction firm in town.
I see.
Even though this was a small town, not a city, it had a certain amount of construction and remodeling work because there were two campuses of the Texas state system in Denton. And so this helped keep that construction firm going through the Depression, and he always had employment during those years. And then eventually they made him the assistant foreman of the planing mill, of the office of commercial, more of the office of commercial side. But there was a lot of work to do at the planing mill as well. In the last 3 years, he was not out on construction projects, which in those days were quite strenuous because they didn't have all the labor-saving devices, and it's a very humid kind of heat in northeast Texas in the summertime.
Well, construction work in any cases is difficult. My grandfather was in construction work, and it is very hard on the body. But I'm really fascinated by the details of growing up in this small town, even though it's a bit off our topic. So what? So did you have, I suppose your house was heated by coal, or?
Well,
did you have...
no, it was not heated by coal. I really don't know how it was heated. The winters in North Texas are not particularly cold, but you do need some kind of heat, and I really don't know how the heat was provided. We did not have a coal system. It didn't seem to cause any particular complication, and it never came to my attention as a child.
Very interesting. So, like in the kitchen, did you have a big stove, like one of those big iron stoves that your mother would keep going, and maybe that heated the house, or fireplace or something?
No, there was no fireplace.
Okay.
There was no fireplace. It was artificial heat. You know, I think the thing is to keep the house closed up. I don't remember ever feeling cold in the North Texas winter, except occasionally when I was out walking to school or something like that. Now that's, of course, given the relative imperviousness of healthy children to the elements, it simply doesn't bother you.
Right. So what was your mother like? Was she from Texas originally? Was she, did she work in those days?
No, my parents were from Colorado.
Okay.
family, that was not saying very much, because what that meant is that she had completed 2 years of nurses training at a sanitarium in the Chicago area when she was young, but lacking family support, she was not able to continue, and she dropped out, and then a year or so later married my father. She had even spent one summer, I think in 1932, before she dropped out, as a nursing assistant in the old Madison General Hospital.
Really?
And so she had been 3 months in Madison, and she shared a small apartment on the third floor of a three-story building with two other nurses. And of course the heat rose on a humid Madison summer, and she remembers the summer of 1932 in Madison as one of the hottest times she ever experienced in her entire life. My father was the son of a Colorado lead miner who died of something like silicosis when he was young, only about 42 years old. He had come from an Iowa farming family. And so my father and his two brothers were put to work when they were very young, my father 12, the older brother 14, the oldest 16, to keep food on the table, to keep the family going. The two younger children, both girls, and they were allowed to continue to go to school. And so the two female siblings both received some degree of education. And one of them became a registered nurse, went into medical missionary work in South America. But my father had to work from the age of 12 years on and developed his own business in Monte Vista, which is up in the hills just a little ways beyond Pueblo, the only car battery shop in the 1920s in that district. But this fell on evil times with the Depression, and at that point he married my mother and set out for Texas, partly with the idea that things might be better down there, but in fact they weren't. And he found that he was really very fortunate to obtain employment as a carpenter, and what would be steady work and always provide a job, and as I mentioned before, it would always put food on the table. Mm-hmm. So we never really suffered any genuine hunger during Depression, any serious want.
So, well, given your family background, and I would say modest opportunities for education in that setting anyway, how did you get from there to an interest in history and a career as a scholar? I mean, that'll be what we'll be discussing, but was there a family member, a teacher, someone in your circle that really inspired you to scholarship, to studying and applying yourself to education?
No, there was no one in my immediate circle. This was what I like to do. And I was a big reader from the age of 6 or 7 on. And so this was kind of a self-generated vocation. But I didn't have a chance to take any history courses until I was well on into high school. And my interest was always oriented toward history, primarily in the sense of reading historical novels when I was very young. And I was the best student in the one high school history class, which I was able to take when I was 16 years of age as a senior in high school. And I remember that my instructor, who was also the principal of this little school, said, "Well, you have some vocation for this. Maybe you'd like to go ahead with history." I said, "Yes, I definitely think I would. I would want to be a history major as an undergraduate." Mm. I don't know what kind of career that leads to, I said, other than to teaching. I never thought of myself as a teacher. And he said to me when I was 16, "Well, perhaps you would like to write history." Well, that seemed to be a daunting task, but when I was only 16 years of age, and I said, that might be a possibility, but it seems like a very ambitious one. He was the first to suggest it when I was 16 years of age, but...
It stuck with you. Someone gave you your path.
that's correct. Really, that was quite clear from... clear is not the word for it. That was indicated from the age of 16. I didn't know what was involved. One just simply... that was my orientation clearly from the age of 16.
So at about the age of 10 or 12, your family left Texas and moved to California?
That's right.
And that's where you went to high school, and I imagine your undergraduate education was there also?
Right, for the next 5 years in Sacramento, and then over in the Napa Valley, where my mother moved as after my parents were divorced, and my undergraduate years were spent in a Seventh-day Adventist college, which is now highly rated as a liberal arts college, but was much more modest in those days, with only about 900 students. Pacific Union College on the eastern slopes of the Napa Valley, really on a hilltop on the eastern side of the valley. Very small academic community, good basic education, nothing special. I used to supplement the college library by ordering books from the California State Library in Sacramento, which seemed to work pretty well. My orientation toward Spanish affairs really began in Texas, not because I was growing up in a very Hispanic part of Texas. This was not the case in those days. In North Texas, there were very few Mexican people. But because the Texas Board of Education in 1943, beginning of my last year of public education in Texas, decided that since we were in the midst of World War II, all Texas school children from the fifth grade on should have a few hours of instruction in a foreign language. They provided no resources for this, so the homeroom teacher simply had to do the best she could for 2 or 3 hours a week in some foreign language, and the language that most of the homeroom teachers selected was Spanish.
Sorry about that. I should answer this. Okay, sorry about the interruptions, Dan, but so we were discussing California, your college career there. So what was Napa like in those years? That must have been, and what was the Seventh-day Adventist college like? Was your family Seventh-day Adventist?
My mother was.
Oh, she was, okay.
Entire family. And so from about the sixth grade on, to the BA, I was educated in Adventist schools. As far as the quality of education was concerned, I would say that it was a good basic education. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was not an elite education. Did not have some of the additional features that you might find in the best kind of elite education, but it was a good basic education and not fundamentally deficient. Of course, it also provided a certain amount of religious training in the environment, although I found that by that time I was dropping out of the church and no longer being a part of it, but I was pretty happy in the college. It was very pleasant, very nice set of students, a very good atmosphere, pleasant ambience. And so I did all 4 years. In fact, doing summer school 1 year was not quite 4 years, but finished my BA there. I found that I was perfectly well prepared for graduate school elsewhere and began moving up the academic ladder. If there was anyone in my education who served as a kind of inspiration, it was my principal history professor at PUC, a man named Walter Utt, suffered severely from hemophilia, which also affected the functioning of his joints so that he was to a large extent crippled as well. And kind of like Franklin Roosevelt, though a little better than Roosevelt, only got around with heavy knee braces. So here is someone who was definitely handicapped and had difficulty manipulating the various features of the mountain environment around PUC, but did it with great courage and was a very effective teacher, and in fact one of the most popular in the college, who also wrote a couple of volumes of history later on. And he and I became very well acquainted, good friends you might say, and he was a source of inspiration for me, certainly to a greater extent than anyone else with whom I came in contact. during my education. I always had good faculty support, I would say, at my graduate education, one way or the other, but Todd was the most important because of the personal relationship and also because of the kind of inspiration that he provided.
So, to just step back a bit, was your family religious? Well, it sounds like your mother had a religious
Definitely,
belief.
But not
yeah.
intensely so. My
okay.
father was not at all. The Napa Valley at that time was totally different, not just somewhat different, but totally different from the Napa Valley of the 21st century. Because we're talking about the period from 1950 to 1955, roughly, by 5 years in the valley.
Interesting. So that was small
was
farms?
It was a totally rural environment. There were really only five producing vintners in the valley. Only five labels producing wine because in the 1950s Americans did not drink wine. And there was no market for that. So this was a very rural, small town environment. And one had the sense as one went up the valley and the density of population declined more and more that beyond the hills at the north end of the valley, the Arctic tundra might begin. I mean, it really had a sense of, though one was less than 100 miles from San Francisco, being at the end of the world, very remote, totally different from the 21st century.
Do you have photos of that period, of that area? Did you take?
I have not been a photo buff ever at any time,
right.
And I have very, very few. Hardly any, I would say.
I think that would be fascinating to look at the transition to what it is now, which is a fantasy land more than anything else
yeah,
for
absolutely.
Wealthy people, right?
It's a fantasy land,
yeah.
A kind of resort area,
yeah.
Wealthy, expensive,
yeah.
Sophisticated. The college itself has changed a good deal, become much, much fancier. I was astounded to find that the food for the students is catered by a firm in San Francisco. This is quite different from the way it was in my time. They still tend to respect the dietary norms of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, but the whole ambience really nonetheless is considerably different from my time. I was prepared for that. I went back, in fact, just 3 years ago, in 2015, as scholar in residence for 2 weeks. So this was the best opportunity I'd ever had to be reacquainted with the college. And I was expecting a lot of change and found even more than I had anticipated.
So that they have acknowledged your contribution to history and your connection with the college. That's great. So how did you end up in New York at Columbia? Is that where you went after your undergrad, or did you get a master's
well,
there?
Well, I didn't make many applications for graduate school, and did not, of course, apply to Berkeley, which was the obvious choice for someone in Northern California. Did not really get much of a fellowship at Berkeley, just an alternate TA ship. But I did get a very good fellowship at Claremont University, then called the Claremont Graduate School, east of Los Angeles in Southern California. So I spent 2 years at Claremont, which was a very helpful experience for me because it served as a kind of transition from a very small college in a rural area of California en route to going to New York, to the big city. It was a crucial transition time, and I'm really very grateful for 2 years that I spent on fellowship at Claremont in the mid-1950s. And then for the PhD, I applied to three institutions, Chicago, Harvard, and Columbia. Chicago provided by far the best fellowship. Columbia and Harvard did not provide such generous terms. But I selected Columbia over Harvard because I thought that someone going to do work in the contemporary history of Spain would make better contacts in a more sophisticated and cosmopolitan environment for that. than in the Boston-Cambridge area. This was a kind of a bet or a guess, and it turned out to be 101% correct. I had turned toward research on Spain at the beginning of graduate school.
At Claremont.
At Claremont.
Okay.
And of course, there was no one either at Claremont or at Columbia who was himself in the field of Spanish history, which we had not studied at that time in North America. But I did have professors who encouraged me to go ahead and do my own research in that field, and that was very important. Of course, without that kind of support, I would not have been able to move farther, but they provided that sort of encouragement down to the end of a PhD degree. And so things moved very fast after I left Claremont. Columbia had an accelerated doctoral program. With my master's degree in hand, I only had to be a regular graduate student for 1 year, was then able to get an SSRC fellowship off to Spain for doctoral research, and back for 1 year teaching in Columbia College and finishing up. So it was a whirlwind Columbia program, one that I was prepared for because the 2 years at Claremont were a necessary transition stage, partly to allow me something to grow up a certain amount before hitting New York City. By the time I got to New York, I was turning 23.
So what year was that, Stan, that you
had? The Columbia years were 1957 to 1960.
So what was New York like in 1957? What was Columbia like? That must have been an experience going from small town California to Columbia and the big city.
Well, the Columbia Graduate School functioned as a graduate program somewhat the way they did at certain European universities or at Oxford and Cambridge. That is, a lot depended on the individual work of the student. You did not have to do very many classes. So it was a kind of experience that was pretty well tailor-made for me because I had become pretty independent by that time and was used to working on my own. And I prepared myself very soon for the PhD prelims, which was the system that they had there. Oral prelims, a 2-hour oral examination, which is very, very important, which I did after only 8 months at Columbia, and did very well. They even offered me a job teaching Latin American history the following year, but I couldn't accept that because I needed to go off to Spain to do my doctoral research. And my thesis advisor at Columbia was Shepard Clough, who was a specialist in French and Italian history. Knowing about Spain, he thought it was very important that other people study Spain, so he supported me all the way. And I do also owe a certain amount to Shepard Clough for the confidence that he showed in me in supporting my work all the way from the selection in the fellowship process in 1957 to completing the degree 3 years later.
Sounds as if this was an intense engagement with your work with scholarship and accelerated program that catapulted you off to Spain for the first time, where you did your initial research in Spain. So tell me about that and about Spain in those years. What did your research entail at that time, and who did you meet over there? What was that experience like?
This was really an extraordinary undertaking in the sense that virtually no one was working in the field of Spanish history at that point. And Spain in the 1950s was totally different from what it would be 20 or 30 years later. This was just before the period of the most accelerated economic development under the Franco regime. It was a time in the 1950s when the dictatorship was still very firmly in place, very little opposition to it at that time. And so the old order obtained. The tenor of Spanish society was very Catholic, very conservative, very formal. I assumed initially this was the way the Spanish always had been. I did not understand that, in fact, the way things were in 1958 in Spain were as a result of the cultural and social and religious counter-revolution carried out by the Franco regime, which reestablished and fostered this kind of culture. And Spain really had So this was a very, very different kind of society, a very special kind of formal and highly Catholic and conservative society, but one that was influenced to some extent by the concern to connect more broadly with the outer world, and not merely illiberal. That is, I encountered a great deal of cooperation and willingness in this society. It was not really as ultra-conservative as it seemed. It was not as rigid as it seemed. There were all kinds of opportunities there. And I was very fortunate, of course, in my dissertation research, because I was working on the early history of the Falange, the fascist state party. But I didn't understand clearly how I would be able to develop primary research in Spain. There was no party archive. There was no primary archive that I could go to. There were all kinds of published materials. But what I found that I was able to do, and this was the advantage of the New York experience, was to engage in oral history. Now, at that time, the term oral history didn't really exist. It was only coined later on in the 60s and 70s. And I had no training in oral history, but this is what I was doing. It was only 20 years after the Civil War. A fair number of people involved were still alive. And I had arrived at exactly the point in time when there was a willingness to sit back and reflect on those years and talk about them and provide a good deal of oral history material. I'd even occasionally produce some documentation. It would not have been possible earlier because the Civil War had been too recent. It might not have been possible for someone who was not an American because there was a special relationship with the United States, and they were particularly concerned to be nice to Americans at that time. And the fact that I was not a Spaniard actually worked to my advantage because they could presume and feel confident that I was not associated with any Spanish political group. Therefore, I had no untoward political motive, whatever I was doing. I seemed to be a doctoral student from Colombia, who was very young and doing research in Spain, and relatively harmless. And all of this worked to my advantage.
So
I got a lot of cooperation in oral history.
And you didn't feel that there was holding back a sense of caution that they might say something that would get them in trouble, or had anyone else attempted to interview them? Did you feel you were the first one to really explore this material and that you had open access? Or did you feel there was a sense of caution?
Oh, of course. There was more than a little holding back. And one has to simply evaluate this and put it in perspective as one goes on, because everything in oral history has to be evaluated and interpreted and used in certain ways. You can't accept what anyone says at face value. Unfortunately, I had just enough experience in contemporary Spanish history to be able to find my way around. On the other hand, it was true that oftentimes people were quite forthcoming, because this was at a phase in the history of the dictatorship when the repression had let up, was not as severe as it had been earlier. It was very, very much a live and let live kind of situation, and many people were not reluctant to talk. In most cases, they were not talking about Franco, and therefore they were not saying things that were likely to get them into any particular political trouble, assuming that I would eventually publish the results of this research. So it was a more fluid situation than one would have expected. As I said, I did not know what I was going to encounter, and I did not understand very clearly how I was going to be able to develop my research. But in fact, everything worked just fine, and I was able to generate a great deal of data very rapidly within about 8 or 9 months of field research in Spain. And I traveled around the country a great deal at that time, more than I ever have during a similar period before or after, because I wanted to meet people in different areas, and I wanted simply to see the country. And it was also a reasonably comfortable country to be in, because there was a level of economic development which made it much more pleasant to be in Spain than, say, in a communist country. And the transportation facilities were reasonably good. simple, they were good, they were efficient, things worked on time, and there was just enough of a level of creature comfort for it to be comfortable without one all existing in any kind of fancy style of life, certainly not that, but just sort of a minimum level of general well-being and efficiency and overall comfort that I was very comfortable that year and adjusted very fast, even though it was a totally different kind of cultural ambience from anything that I'd lived in down to that point.
So it was still very traditional, especially if you were traveling to smaller towns. I imagine that was an immersion into a Spain that probably doesn't really exist anymore. This was before Costa del Sol development, all of the tourism. So what were your impressions of life in Spain in those years? Was it still very traditional, as you said, very Catholic, of course, but...
It was, in fact, I think the word which I often use is neo-traditional, because there had been an effort after the Civil War to restore traditional manners and style. And so that was what impressed you at first. And then coming to the United States, this was an underdeveloped country, though it was not a merely backward country, just an underdeveloped country, a European country, but one that did not function at the same level as most West European countries. It was, in terms of its level of economic development, much more like an East European or some other South European country, not a typically North or West European country. But what I did not understand at that time was the capacity for rapid acceleration in modernization, which existed just at that point. And in fact, it was the very month when I left Spain, in June 1959, that the government installed the liberalization program in economic policy, which encouraged foreign investment and more of an opening to the outer world and accelerated development, so that by 1960, 1961, the economy was taking off. The other thing I didn't understand was that the country had made a good deal of progress during the 1950s, and the reason why I found Spain comfortable, if underdeveloped, in 1958 was because by that time things were much better than they'd been in 1948. Then came the boom of the 1960s and everything changed and changed very rapidly. So that overall I can say that in the past 60 years, Spain has changed more proportionally than the United States.
So do you think that your being in the right place at the right time, getting that initial insight into the motivations of those who I assume were on the right in the Spanish Civil War in most cases, mm-hmm. that this gave you, that this formed your approach to this conflict, to this period. And that was in contrast to that which was the given approach in the U.S., in Europe at that time, where the Spanish Civil War was still considered the great event of the century, a very intensely politicized event still in the West, very much driven by the memories of those who had fought against the fascists, and in particular in that period after the war where anything remotely related to fascism stirred up a huge and fairly predictable response. And you had these insights coming from a more, shall we say, empathic view of some of the actors. And by empathic, I mean understanding from within, not necessarily sympathizing, but understanding the thought processes from within. And do you think that started when you were on your initial research trip there? Did that really form your some of your approach to this history?
Well, so, that was an important part of the research process and of my understanding of Spanish affairs and the way that I wrote up the first book. In general, I had accepted and continued to espouse the same attitudes toward the Spanish Civil War, which is at least a moderately leftist attitude that, as you pointed out, is common in the Western world at that time and afterward, and that was still the framework within which I operated. But on the other hand, I was dealing with a fascist movement and trying to understand these people, and I was surprised that they mostly seemed fairly normal people, and often, on a personal level, even rather likable people. So that one had to understand them, as you're suggesting, from the inside out, and to grasp what really made them tick and what their point of view was, so that I think I was able to develop a pretty objective kind of dissertation. It was published by the Stanford Press, became my first book on Falange in 1961, and it was very, very well received. I don't think I ever got hardly a single negative review of that book.
Really?
I've often said, in fact, that I should have stopped right then after the first book. I would never get such a positive response to a volume again after that time. It humanized the leader of the Falange, José Antonio Primo de Rivera, who had a very attractive individual personality, though he was involved in very radical and destructive politics, and the fact that it did present a more empathic study of these people from the inside out. I recommended it to all kinds of people, and I received very little criticism on the left because it was clear to leftist reviewers that my general framework of values and interests is not very different from their own, but I was trying to understand a group of human beings, and this was generally accepted. So that Harvey Goldberg, for example, in Wisconsin a few years later, when he developed his big 500-student course on the history of revolution for a couple of years, used this book as one of his volumes of required reading, because if you're going to understand what makes revolutions work, you should understand a failed fascist revolution, such as what happened in Spain as well. So,
well,
that book had a great deal of appeal simply because of those qualities.
And because it was pioneering, I imagine.
And because it was pioneering, there was nothing at all on that at that time.
And probably nothing on German fascism at that point, or Italian fascism.
Well, these were the only countries on which there was any literature at that time, on Germany and on Italy. Italy to a much lesser extent than English.
Mm-hmm.
But the other fascist movements, the beyond those two immediate founding fascist countries, were not studied yet in English, for that matter, in other languages. So this was something of a pioneering work in that field, and had a long life, remained in print for 35 years.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to get going. So you came back to the U.S. and you applied for jobs, I assume. You had your degree from Columbia, and well, maybe I'll ask you here. When did you meet Juan Linz? Was he on your dissertation committee? I mean, was he involved in your education, or was that later that you met him?
No, I met Juan on my second day in Madrid, second or third day in Madrid.
Okay.
He had written to me over the summer because he saw that I had a pre-doctoral grant to do research in Spain, and he had just been awarded a post-doctoral grant to work on Spanish politics. And so he said that we should get in touch with each other, and he gave me his address and phone number, and so I got a hold of him my very first week in Madrid. And I probably learned more from Juan about Spanish affairs during that first semester than from anyone else. But he was someone who Spanish political regime from the inside out, having initially as a very young person worked for the regime. He really understood, and Juan had a brilliant analytical mind, so he could explain a variety of things that probably no one else would have been capable of explaining for me. Juan was very important in my intellectual formation and in my capacity for political observation and analysis at that time. My considered opinion is that Juan, in terms of comparative politics, the analysis of the field of comparative politics, the most brilliant person that I've known during my entire academic period. He was simply the top political sociologist.
In some ways, your approach, your analytical approach, has a similarity to his in its conciseness and rational organization. Do you think that you were influenced in your writing style and your research style by him directly, or was that something that you just felt that you both had a kind of sympathetic approach to it?
I'm sure that Juan has influenced my understanding and possibly even my interpretive approach to political affairs. It's hard to sort these things out because
right.
Your suggestion is a perfectly logical and reasonable one, and I'm sure Juan had some effect on that. It could not really have been otherwise. From that time forward, I was very puzzled by the whole historical phenomenon of fascism, because I had not the slightest hesitation in subtitling my dissertation book, The History of Spanish Fascism. I was sure that the Falange was a fascist type movement, and yet at that point, had you really pinned me down and asked me to explain what a fascist type movement was, I would have replied only in the terms of the sort of vague generalizations that most people used, particularly at that time, of course, for that matter, still do today. So that it left the question mark in my mind, assuming that my interpretation is correct, just how does this relate to other kinds of European fascism? What are the overall parameters of European fascism? And what is the role of the Spanish movement within that framework? So that was something that I puzzled over for, in fact, the next 20 years, until it finally got down to publishing the book on the comparative analysis of fascism in 1980. So the entire period of the 60s and 70s, in the back of my mind, I had this question and was collecting data and library resources on fascism until the point that I finally that I was able to write about this effectively at the very end of the 1970s.
And you were really the only one doing that at that point. It was not, what were the main questions that were being asked about fascism in those years? I mean, it seems to me that you had the Shire book, you had Bullock, you had these general histories that were hugely influential in terms of German fascism, but there wasn't much else going on, it seems to me, in terms of comparative fascism or what then George helped pioneer in the cultural aspect.
That only began to develop, I would say, about the middle of the 1960s. And George was probably the first to take a major step forward in that. There then did ensue by the 1970s what has been called the fascism debate, in which there were a variety of historians and also people in the social sciences who were trying to get a broader kind of analytical handle on fascism would ask certain basic questions such as, is there such a thing as generic fascism? That is fascism as a broader phenomenon, as a general phenomenon, actually exist in a way that you can talk about it, or is one simply dealing with a tendency which is expressed in a series of individual movements that ultimately have only a very limited amount in common? So that was one of the major questions. The other was, of course, is to understand George was the first in that regard. Mm-hmm. And along with this, there were other questions that people wanted to ask him. For example, what is the fascist economic policy? Is fascism a revolution? And so on and so forth. The problem was that the fascism debate did not take a terribly organized form. That is, people would not systematically carry through comparative studies. They would organize conferences. They would publish collective works with chapters on different topics, chapters on different movements. The only person who had written a general book on fascism, of course, was the German scholar Ernst Nolte, who published his book on Der Faschismus in seiner Epoche, Fascism in its Epoch. It's got a rather less accurate English translation title, Three Faces of Fascism, which didn't get to the heart of the matter as well as the German title. Came out in English in 1965. And then the book also that Eugene Weber, my colleague at UCLA, published about the same time in 66 to 67, in a series published by, I think it was Van Nostrand, called The Varieties of Fascism, which dealt with the different kinds of fascism within different countries, with just a few paradigmatic text quotations from the programs and speeches of the leaders of those movements. So there was just a little bit of overarching literature, but mainly it had to do with more and more monographs and books which were collective works, collective conferences, but no systematic analysis. And my first efforts to try to get something done in this regard around 1968 or 1970 were not very successful. But when I was asked to participate in a conference in the summer of 1972 at Bergen, Norway, at the Comparative Politics Institute in Bergen, on the social basis of fascist movements, I really did a two-part paper, one on the social basis of Spanish fascism, the second on a kind of prototype of general fascist movements to try to draw these things together. And I remember afterwards when I delivered this paper and came back to sit down, I was seated in the audience by Juan Lentz, and Juan leaned over and said, that was very good, that made a real contribution. That was the first time in 1972 when I began to develop some confidence that I might be able to complete this kind of comparative analysis study and make it really work and be effective.
Well, let's go back to the trajectory of your career. So you got your graduate, your doctoral degree in what year was that?
1960.
Okay, already in 1960. That was quick. So where did you first get hired? Was it UCLA or?
I taught in Columbia College. 8 hours a week when I had my third year at Columbia, finishing my degree. Jobs were not easy to get at the end of the 1950s. And Clough, my advisor, knew the profession quite well. And he got me a job teaching 9 hours a week, three different courses, two preparations at Hunter College during the spring semester. So it was a good thing that I had already completed the dissertation, because my last semester in the doctoral program, I was teaching 17 hours a week, which involved a total of 10 hours a week of class preparation. So I was a busy fellow that final semester in New York. Then I got a job in the Comparative Civilizations program, teaching survey courses at Stanford on a 3-year contract in 1960. And I liked the idea. Of course, I was from Northern California, and I liked the idea, going back to Palo Alto, where I had done a certain amount of research in the summertime in the Hoover Institution. But then at the last minute, in June 1960, I received a phone call from the chairman of history at Minnesota saying they were offering me a tenure-track job. Stanford had already agreed to release me from my contract with them, so I went to Minnesota because there I had the possibility of earning tenure and going all the way up the academic ladder. Spent the 2 years, 60 to 62, at Minnesota and enjoyed it. It was a pleasant place. The atmosphere in the history department was very congenial. It was a small department, had only about 27 or 28 professors, not nearly as big as some of the others at that time. then after the publication of the first book in the winter of 61-62, got two job offers from other institutions, one from the University of Illinois in Urbana and the other from UCLA, and finally decided to accept the offer from UCLA. Taught there for 6 years, from 62 to 68, and then came to Wisconsin in 1968.
So, what was the department like at UCLA in those years? Was there, did you make some close friendships? Was it a stimulating intellectual environment? I imagine that that was a place that you had a lot of the stirrings of the student revolt of those years. What was that like there? Were there individuals that stand out that you recall?
It was a reasonably good department.
Yeah.
Larger than Minnesota, not as big as Wisconsin. At that time, Wisconsin was 50% larger than UCLA. Now UCLA has not 50% more, but distinctly more FTEs and professorships than Wisconsin does.
And it's rated one of the top history programs.
It wasn't rated quite that highly then, but it had a good rating. It was rated near the top of the second decile. It was rated about 12th or thereabouts, 12th or 13th in the country. It was a good department. It did not have a very intense interdepartmental intellectual life at that time. And one always saw in Los Angeles the influence of the Hollywood environment on the campus culture, in which things were a little laid back and lacking in intensity and dynamism. But they treated me well, and I certainly was not at all uncomfortable there. But after a while, living in Los Angeles simply begins to grate on you if you're not a Southern California hedonist kind of person, as neither myself nor my wife Julie were at that time, and we decided that we would be willing to leave, and that's when Wisconsin entered the picture in 1968.
So Eugene Weber wasn't there in those years.
Oh yes, he was.
Oh, he was. So I bet, because I know
Eugene Weber was one of the main reasons for them making me the offer and bringing me to UCLA, because he was the chair of the search committee. And he was interested in appointing someone in a new area of modern European history who was also interested in fascism and doing good work on the topic. So,
well, and he was
had a great deal to do with it. He was my Eugene was my main patron, in fact, at that time at UCLA.
Makes sense, because if he wrote this book, this pioneering book on an approach to comparative fascism, and that was something that he was very interested in, I could see why he would want you there also. And that became a long-term friendship then between the two of you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we were certainly good friends, and he was my patron, but we did not become close friends. Probably my best friend among the faculty there was a young economics professor, Clay LaForce, who later went on to a major administrative role UCLA, but he had been doing research in Spanish economic history back in 58 in Madrid, and he probably was a closer friend on the individual level than anyone in the history department. I did not form close friendships in the history department itself at UCLA. Eugene was not a personal friend to the same extent that George was, for example.
Right.
Although he would have been the equivalent of George at UCLA because of modern European cultural and intellectual history.
Well, they were friends. I mean, I think that Eugene Weber was not a person that was easily intimate with, or that became friendly with you, from what I, there was always a bit of a distance there.
Yes.
Yeah, because I think that was true of him and George too, but anyways, so, well, maybe we'll take a little aside and I'll just ask you about your political engagement in those years. So you've told me in the past that you were a traditional Kennedy liberal Democrat in the early 60s that you may have even worked for Kennedy's election?
No, I didn't work for the Kennedy election. I first, by chance, happened to encounter the woman whom I married in Minneapolis, Judy Sherman, a psychologist at the Kennedy campaign headquarters, where I stopped in one night. But I never worked. I had no involvement, really, with politics at that time. You know, I had pretty much the conventional ideas politically of most professors, but was not involved in politics and did not see the university as playing any kind of political role. So I was rather shocked by the rapid and intense politicization of the university in the late 1960s. Yeah. That was not the kind of university that I had begun with in the 50s. Quite different, and I thought it was a very serious perversion of university life. The atmosphere in UCLA was quite different, because you have to understand the ambience on that campus. UCLA campus was then, I think still is to a large extent, a commuter campus. It doesn't have the same kind of campus life that a place like Wisconsin has, or that Berkeley has. The students tend to live at least some distance away. And it did not undergo politicization in 65, 66, 67, when Berkeley was leading the country in student politicization.
And Madison, too.
Madison,
those
too.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
And UCLA was very different. Yeah. It changed very rapidly after I left in 1968, not because I left, but that was really what happened. There was a real burst of radical politicization in 1969, but not in my time. And UCLA very much reflected, in those years before 68, Southern California life in general, which is pretty dissociate, much less of a communitarian kind of existence.
It was more like an extension of the 50s, in a sense, there, in the sense that it wasn't, it was more, well, easygoing, not as politicized, not as culturally radical.
Not as culturally radical, and also simply socially less organized and less focused.
Yes.
People lived farther away. You didn't have as many people living close to campus
as
would be the case in Madison.
Do you want to take a little break now, Stan? Or?
I think I'll just put on my jacket and you know, like a city here or not.
Okay, so we're at 1968. And you are on your way to Madison. I imagine George was involved in your hire. He must have been on the committee because your work had resonance with it.
Chair of the committee.
Oh, he was. Okay. Well, that.
Very sharp parallel between the role of Eugene Weber at UCLA in 62 and of George at Wisconsin in 68.
Yes. Well, in a way, they were building the field. They were building an area of shared interest and research, and that's what you should do. That's what gives you the kind of resonance that's needed to attract graduate students and to make a mark, seems to me. But anyways, so you decided to come back and from UCLA and come to Madison. You were coming from UCLA, or was it Madison?
No, directly from UCLA.
Yeah, okay. So that's interesting, and you gave us your reasons of why. So of course you knew the reputation of the history department at UW. So what was that like when you first came to the department? What's the department like?
It was a different kind of experience because it was the biggest history department that I've ever been associated with. At that time, in 1968, the Wisconsin History Department was at its all-time height. My memory is accurate. It had at that time 67 professors. didn't have 67 FTEs. We only had about 60 or 62 FTEs because some of the professors were joint appointees of other departments.
Okay.
But it was a very big department, and it had a gigantic program of graduate instruction with something like 700 graduate students on the books.
Oh my God.
That is about 11 graduate students on the books for every single history professor. It was just a huge program. The only other program of that scale in graduate instruction would have been Columbia at that time. Whereas the graduate program in those years at UCLA was much smaller. And graduate students, although we certainly had a certain number, we did teach a certain number of graduate seminars at UCLA, we didn't have the volume that Wisconsin had. And the whole structure and feel of things was totally different in Wisconsin compared with UCLA or Minnesota because of that. And the organization was surprisingly informal. In most departments, graduate students were received into programs in various set, organized ways within certain kinds of niches. The structure of things was very much individualized in Wisconsin, very European, very in a sense, old-fashioned, in which graduate admissions were carried out not by the department, but by the individual instructor who decided which students that instructor wanted to admit. This was not unprecedented in other places, but it was not the way it was done in most places. There was a great deal of autonomy for the faculty. They brought in their own graduate students. They could really bring in, at that point, as many as they wanted, as they could handle. And they were supported primarily by TA ships. Because of the history boom, there was all the money you could possibly use for TA ships available at that time. And it was not rationed out. What was going on, of course, was that the 60s were the height of the history boom. The golden age of history study in North America was the decade of the 1960s, reinforced by the radical politics, because the radical students believed that history was possibly the most important thing for them to study. They could learn about society and government and about power and how to gain power and how power was structured. This was the queen of the arts, and there's never been a time during the past century when history was as popular with students in general as it was during the 1960s. And that would mean also for a period of about 8 years, from 1962 to 1968, there were jobs galore on the history market. Literally everybody got a job. In fact, many new PhDs got jobs before they completed their degrees. They were ABDs, who were given acting assistant professor positions just to have bodies to fill the need for teaching slots in various places around the country. Yeah, there's never been a time like that. It was absolutely an extraordinary period. A great boom for history enrollment all the way around, for history jobs, and also, of course, for history publication, because the publishers follow the market trends. And therefore, you were in situations by 1965, 66, 67, that you would find major publishers offering textbook contracts to junior faculty because they couldn't get anyone else to take them. I remember being offered a major contract to write a kind of textbook on the history of 20th century Europe, and I had the wit to turn that down because I realized that I was really not prepared to write that kind of broad and demanding kind of book at that stage in my career.
In many ways, it was the, like you said, the golden age of both essentially free public education, very high quality education. There was a commitment to providing access to the masses. And then you had this huge explosion of the humanities in general and in history on this camp, on the campus of UW in particular. That then also had huge political resonance, because that I mean, I think you could make the case that the history department was the epicenter for the student revolt in those. The most of the leaders were there in that department. Most of the activity generated on campus related to protests had a huge history department component. And you're telling me that there were 700 graduate students. Many of those graduate students were up to their, you know, were very politically involved on the left, of course, essentially. There was, of course, that the right reaction to that that's less known. That was the time when George had 38 graduate students, PhDs, dissertators in his career. And I would say the vast majority were within that 10-year period, because he essentially stopped taking graduate students in 72 when that bubble collapsed, essentially, in the early 70s. He stopped taking students. And so I've always wondered, but I've never really looked into it, but where in the world, I mean, he must have had about 20 students every year that he was supervising in those years, and you're mentioning that department must have been incredibly active, and the hallways must have been buzzing, and it must have been an exciting time to be there, I would assume.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Obviously, Wisconsin in 68, 69, 70 was a more lively place than UCLA, and there was more internal activity among the faculty. People had more to do with each other. There was more of academic social life than at UCLA. And things were much more concentrated. And to that extent, they were also more intense during that time. Of course, George was very present in those years. When I came to take possession of my office the very first day of the fall semester in 1968, the first person who said hello was George coming down the hallway when he heard that I was there, with a great beaming smile on his face. I never will forget that. And I've never seen George beam more than on that particular occasion. So it was very nice to see that. It made one feel very welcome. Mm-hmm. And within just a year or so, at George's suggestion, we got the money to have a visiting lecture series on fascism. I think that was in 1970-71, different specialists from different institutions around the country to talk about basically different countries and different movements. So there were more, shall we say, extracurricular academic programs and activities at Wisconsin, more money available for graduate studies, study because of the large number of history students, the large undergraduate enrollment, and it certainly was a very lively and exciting time. And one could never have guessed in 68, 69 that this was only going to last a very few more years. Mm-hmm. Although it was a good thing that after the Stirling Hall bombing in the summer of 1970, the student radicalization group died down. That did change very fast. And one could not imagine that was going to change as rapidly as it did. Mm-hmm. So it was very fast moving. And then fast-moving changes right after that period. One only begins to understand these things as one looks back on them with personal and historical perspective. And we, I think, did not completely perceive how unique the circumstances of the Wisconsin History Department were at that time. We knew they were different, and yet we somehow assumed that maybe this was the beginning of a new normal. It was not at all. It was just a very special time.
I remember I was there at the tail end of that, and what you're saying really resonates, because I think there was this this belief that this was just the beginning of something that was going to grow, and that this would be continued. And there's still a great deal of nostalgia about that period, not only culturally, politically, or whatever, but just in terms of access to jobs, the academic atmosphere, the opportunities, the excitement. I think there's that is the golden period that still resonates so strongly even with young people coming into the field. I think they still feel that there's this potential.
Well, there were two particular aspects to it. One, there simply was the money and the student enrollment base, so there were lots of jobs. And that really changed by 1971. In 1971, there simply were not nearly as many jobs. It changed very fast. It was kind of like falling off a cliff. It was not a gradual decline at all, but very abrupt. And ever since that time, it's been a struggle for people trying to get jobs in the humanities. Mm. And often the jobs have not been there. And the other part of course, was what you just referred to, the sense of novelty and excitement, that new fields were opening up then. Mm-hmm. There were important areas that had never been studied. People could do all kinds of new things. And this created a kind of excitement that after the new areas were opened up, no longer existed either. Because by the end of the century, the trend was toward micro fields, the small topics in social and cultural history, which were minuscule in breadth, oftentimes minuscule in importance, virtually verging sometimes on trivialization, quite different from the atmosphere of the 60s and early 70s.
And that has only increased as time has passed, it seems to be. There is this kind of attempt to specialize on the minuscule in vast areas of the history profession. It seems to be that's the way that students are trained, a lot of them. So it's fascinating that the difference between the kind of history George did.
Well, the 60s were the last phase, you might say, of high modernism. This was not a postmodern era. People were certain that they had the truth. They may not have been any more accurate than anyone else, but they believed that the truth could be understood. And therefore, it was important to deal with the major problems, the major issues that contributed to the truth. Not the kind of skeptical attitude that you get by the end of the century, in which the route to follow is trivialization because it doesn't make any difference anyway. Mm-hmm. It's just a totally different kind of mindset.
Mm-hmm. So were you aware of George's work before you came to UW? I imagine you were.
Yes,
his reputation.
Yes, I really had not read most of it in detail, but I was aware of it. Mm-hmm. The thing that really caught my attention to George, because I didn't pick up on the first book on German Völkisch culture for a year or two, was the publication of the Journal of Contemporary History in 1966. That caught my eye right away.
And that was a unique journal in its comparative approach, which resonated with your approach.
Two things. The comparative approach and the resolutely contemporary history approach. Mm-hmm. Which was enshrined in the title. So it was really a breath of fresh air, very new. And it caught one's attention. I would give a charter subscriber even before I came to Madison.
Hmm.
Because this is obviously something which was absolutely going to shake things up. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely new.
And so when did you have your first article published in the journal? Was that must have been in the 60s or 70s, I imagine.
Maybe my first journal article, or my first in the Journal of Contemporary History?
Journal of Contemporary History.
I didn't publish anything in the Journal of Contemporary History for about 10 years after I came to Wisconsin.
Oh, really? Okay.
I never published very much in the Journal of Contemporary History. And in fact, compared with a lot of historians, I did not publish that many articles. I was always concentrating on books, and mm-hmm. so that my article production in terms of number of articles was not as great as that of some other people. In books, it was a different story.
Right.
I did not concentrate much on articles, particularly those early years.
Yes. So, what was the European group like at UW in those years? You had Ted Hamerow, you had Harvey Goldberg. It was a distinguished group of very individualistic people, strong personalities. You had George, of course.
Yeah, it was a strong field. It was a sizable field. There were 20 or more Europeanists. The European group was almost the size of what a few years earlier the entire Minnesota History Department had been. And it was very individualistic in that, as you say, there were strong personalities, a lot of achievement, some very hard workers, and people who got in some others who were not such hard workers. But very individualistic in that every senior professor especially ran his own show, and everyone who was a full professor, I came in as a full professor, I've been promoted to full professor at UCLA in 1967, but he was part of a counteroffer here in Wisconsin, as a full professor could admit his own grad students, and in fact I admitted two grad students for the fall of 1968. The very first dissertators to work under me came in at that time, because I really had not had any graduate students of my own working directly under me. I only worked with other people's graduate students at UCLA.
And essentially, as you said, in those years, you admitted your own students without a committee selection process. And that gave you a great deal of control over, well, your work. When did that change? When did it move to that committee arrangement?
It began to change later on in the 70s. The first to change were the people in American history. A factor here was a decline in the student enrollment on the undergraduate level. Because the fallback position at Wisconsin always was, after the first year, you could support graduate students with TA-ships. That didn't really mean that most students had TA-ships any given year, because a lot of the 700 students were sort of part-time graduate students. They weren't working terribly hard to finish their degree, but those who really wanted to go on and needed to meet requirements and so forth could normally get jobs as TAs. And it became clear as the 70s developed, this was no longer the case. And so the Americans first decided they would control admissions by means of a committee system, and then this might have put some pressure on the Europeans, but the Europeans were very slow to change. So the Europeans, in fact, did not change for quite a long time afterwards. They simply held out and continued to do their own thing for some time. For some time, the old European system did not change.
So you mentioned that some of the students, some of the graduate students were intensely serious and career driven and others weren't. Do you know what proportion of, say, that 700 students actually ended up getting their PhDs and moving on? Would you have any
No, no, I would not, because I would say of that 700, probably a significant proportion did not.
That would be my understanding too in those years. I think now that's really not the case. I think if you start in the program, you generally finish with a doctorate for various reasons. I mean, some people do, not finish, but it's very rare. But so when you came in 1968, that was the year that George stopped spending a lot of time in Madison. So you kind of, he was transitioning to being gone much more. I mean, it's my understanding that George never really taught full time at Wisconsin. He had a very small pension because of this. I think when he was hired, even when he was hired, he was hired on the basis of having a certain leave on paid leave built into his hiring description. And then when he became the Baskin professor, he even taught less. So it's quite extraordinary when you think of what he managed to accomplish as a teacher, and the fact that he wasn't actually at Wisconsin all that much compared to some of his colleagues who were there spring and fall every year.
It was paradoxical because George was very dedicated to teaching, and he liked to teach the survey course.
Yes, the beginning course. Yeah.
Down to the late 60s. He was hired, in fact, in part because of his teaching ability and his reputation in the classroom and doing the survey course, because the Americanists had dominated the department back in the 50s, and they felt that the Europeans were weak by comparison and weren't holding their end up, as they wanted to bring someone in who could really rev up the basic course in European history. And of course, with George, they had exactly the right person. And the other thing, of course, that he didn't have the opportunity to do to Iowa was to have the same kind of graduate program, and that simply took off. But it was kind of paradoxical. On the one hand, he was devoted to that, but later on, it became less important to him. He developed different dimensions in life, so that kind of stimulation in the undergraduate classroom particularly was not as important to him as it had been later on. George was a certain kind of campus personality for those first 13 years in Wisconsin, a leader in campus affairs, very actively involved. This really was a major focus of his life. I think that he found with the changes in the university and the more politicized university that it really was not the same kind of environment, the same kind of institution that he dealt with. And he was interested in finding more intellectual stimulation in other ways. And then with the decline of the graduate program, he found his intellectual stimulation more in his relationship with other colleagues in Jerusalem or in Europe or in traveling, and less in dealing with a large number of graduate students, because particularly before 1968, George apparently led a very intense life with his grad students.
Mm-hmm.
And after 68, this dwindled fairly fast.
Mm-hmm.
So one develops different dimensions and different ways of dealing with things, depending on different phases of one's life. But George's career actually changed more than most, just as his life probably changed somewhat more than most people's lives changed during the course of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he lived in several different kinds of worlds.
And that intense immersion in that particular period, what we mentioned as the Golden Age, was for him probably the height of teaching and graduate supervision and a kind of height of his involvement, certainly at Wisconsin, because he was involved in a lot of committee work. He was a presence on campus. He was very much involved with Hillel, with a lot of activities on campus. And as you're saying, that began to taper off then after 68.
You know, George, I only saw this in the aftermath, but he obviously had been a dominant and dynamic kind of campus force in the late 50s and 60s. I think particularly that period around 1960 to 68, when he'd been in Wisconsin for a number of years and really had established himself and knew his way around and had a strong reputation. He played a very important role in campus affairs, and that seems to be the case after 68.
Well, I know he mentioned that he did some stints on the divisional committee, and that he and Jermaine Bray were tough as nails in terms of, you know, who they would let onto the faculty. And he was involved, I know. He never had a direct affiliation with the Institute for Research in Humanities for some reason. I don't know why, but he didn't.
One of the reasons there is that George felt then, when he was not teaching, he wanted to be doing research
somewhere
elsewhere,
else. Yeah,
and not
sense.
In
So he had more opportunities than perhaps some of his colleagues. That makes sense. Yeah. But I know he said that he brought in a lot of noted speakers like Herbert Yedin and people that he worked with the Humanities Institute to engage, like noted scholars who would come for periods of time, that there was a lot more money in those years for that kind of thing.
And there was.
Yeah. And did you do the same thing? Did you have colleagues come and bring, have a lot of people coming through?
Well, the money began to diminish, but you know, I always did that to some extent. And George and I did that together in the series that we directed in 1970.
Mm-hmm. So did you, although George at that point was stepping back from supervising graduate students, I assume that the two of you were on committees together, that you perhaps informally were building a field at Wisconsin in terms of, well, the study of right-wing movements, the study of fascism, of right-wing populism. Is that the case, or were you doing that deliberately, or was this more informal?
Well, it was more informal, I think, and we were doing that, but basically in the more of George was gone half the time. In fact,
right.
If you took it on a 12-month basis, he might be gone more than 50% of the time.
Oh, yes.
So we sort of did this informally ourselves. This is what we were focusing on and working on, and of course I learned a good deal from George in that regard. We each did our own thing, but we were working in parallel areas.
Mm-hmm.
In
those years,
all the way up to 1980.
Yeah.
And then after I turned to other things in the decade of the 1980s, when I reached a point in the early 90s, I'm going to have time now available for another project. George said to me, perhaps you want to write a big history of fascism. And I thought, well, in fact, that's a very attractive topic. I have written a comparative analysis of fascism, which is more like a political science book. Now the time has come to write a general history of fascism. And so that became the book that was published in 1995.
Mm-hmm. That got a lot of attention and good response. Yes. Well, in a way, it's unfortunate that there wasn't more understanding of what could have been developed here in terms of, I mean, I think it informally it happened. I think Madison had that reputation because of the great scholars that were here in that field, and both you and George pioneered, well, I guess you could say a revisionist approach to current interpretations of fascism at that period. So you probably attracted students automatically because of that. I wonder if it would have even been possible, you know, to develop a school of fascist studies. You know, it may not have gone very well in terms of, I don't know, but it seems to me that Wisconsin would have been the place to do that. You know,
it might have been.
Right.
We never had the idea of developing a, you know, the very nomenclature would seem anomalous. You know, your Center for Fascist Studies.
Right.
No, it would be for perhaps it would have to be somewhat broader in terms of right wing and totalitarian movements. So the ethos of the history department, though, of course, in those years was very individualistic. And so George did not really think in terms of developing a center. nor did I. It was not something that I especially wanted to do either. Now, a little later on, the regional campus that did develop that kind of ambition was the University of Minnesota, early in the 1990s. And they had a center for the study of, what do they call it, right-wing and neo-fascist movement, something like that. But it fizzled.
Oh, did it?
It only lasted for 2 or 3 years, and then they decided, well, they weren't generating the activity or the support, and they were going to have to cast it, so it didn't last very long at all. I went to one of their conferences about 1993 or thereabouts, and soon I found that they ceased to exist.
That's interesting. Well, so you arrived on campus just at the point where the anti-war movement was developing into a more confrontational, radical approach. And I recall in those years that there were so many sectarian groups on the left, and that each one tried to outdo each other in terms of radicalism and extreme political ideas. You had the Revolutionary Union, which was Maoist. You had the more traditional communist party. And then you had the New Left Party, the SDS. It was an incredibly unique time, I would say, certainly in my lifetime. So what was your, and then you did actually have a reaction to that in terms of a number of individuals who were here in Madison in those years, who then went on to prominent positions in the American political right. So what was your impression of that period of political and social ferment in Madison when you first arrived, and what was that like in the department? How did it impact?
Well, I thought it was generally destructive for the university because they politicized, that means a sectarian university, develops the exact opposite of what should be the ideals of scholarship, which is impartiality and relative disinterest in certain kinds of outcomes. Now, it's easy to say that. Everyone wants to be objective, and the problem of objectivity in history is a profound one, so that it's only achieved to a certain extent and in certain kind of ways. But to have the goal of a university program be bias and sectarianism in and of itself is simply to give up on the whole university enterprise, I thought. So,
and did you feel that
it was basically a perversion of the university, and that it was necessary to simply ride out the storm as best one could?
Did you feel that that was the direction that the department was going, or that is the direction that it has pursued over the years?
The department did not suffer any significant internal politicization or splits. The members of the department in the late 60s were all products of the 40s and 50s of university, in which the goals and values were based on scholarship and professional achievement, and therefore that one would not try to politicize one's own bailiwick or one's own institutional structure. And although some members of the department were very sympathetic to the student New Left, others very much not. What was, very positive about the Wisconsin department in those years was that it never suffered any internal splits. That is, those faculty who were particularly sympathetic to the New Left, like Harvey Goldberg or Ed Gargan or some people in American history, did not try to weaponize this within departmental relations.
Mm.
They maintained pretty much complete neutrality inside the department. And this made it possible for the department to maintain a kind of professional unity and harmony that was not as threatened by student radicalization as one might have thought. So that made the department a much more livable place.
It's interesting that you say that, because George would say that, you know, Harvey actually, within the department structure, was not all that supportive of students, the radicals, that he wasn't this kind of firebrand within the department that you would expect him to be. He was actually quite conservative about some of those matters.
Harvey, in many ways, was an old-fashioned historian.
Yes,
history
he was. Yeah.
So he was not trying to use radical student politics as a tool to subvert the history department, nor was there really anyone in the department who was doing that at that time. So the department maintained its internal culture and its internal unity pretty well, was quite cohesive. That was perhaps the very best single thing about the Wisconsin department in those years, that maintained its internal values and structure, even though there was quite a division of political opinion among the various professors.
So, I mean, the whole field has been so transformed, both in terms of, in the course of your career, in terms of the areas that are given more attention, more resources. The fields of European history have been somewhat marginalized in recent years, whereas other areas of history, such as Asian history, have exploded in terms of the number of faculty, the resources. Also, the approaches to history have changed so radically since the time you were describing, when the department had a more of a cohesive attitude and perhaps more similarity in background than what you see now, although that hasn't changed all that much, I have to say. But I don't think it would have been possible to sustain that model that you're discussing here. That model would never have lasted much longer than it did. But when did the divisions start to emerge that were so difficult for the department in the 90s, I think, in particular?
The politicization within the department had nothing to do with the radical students. It depended upon the broader workings through of the culture of the new political tendencies through the 70s and 80s, and did not really emerge until the mid-90s with new appointments and some of the fields, new fields which were particularly political fields, such as women's history, which came in with an agenda, and some other areas like that. That probably was the main entering wedge. Other things developed from that time on. But the 70s and 80s were a period of slow transition, the aging of the cohort. The history part of 1970 did not have very many people near retirement age.
Hmm.
It was at that time a department disproportionately of young full professors. And again, when one lives through unusual times like that, you don't realize entirely how unusual they were. But you didn't have a kind of a normal overall age distribution. There had been a lot of appointments made in the 1960s, and most of these people gained tenure, and you had a very heavily tenured department by 1970, and disproportionately of full professors. So we all aged in place during the 70s and 90s.
87.
Was it 87?
He was 70 in 87. Yeah.
No,
69. He would have been 69. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought he'd gone on. I remember he'd gone on until 70. Guess not.
He may have come back to teach every other year or something for a few years there. Yeah, but I think his official retirement was.
Particularly when you saw the Europeans retire, the late 80s and early 90s.
Right. Yeah.
And so there were new appointments in European history for the first time in years by the early 90s, mm-hmm. and some changeover, and some of the new appointees were pretty good, and some were not. Though the department did not particularly suffer from those new appointees at that time, they do generally with people who held their end up. Mm-hmm. The more radical changes would come with new appointees that were brought in more at the end of the 20th century and in the early 21st century, and then one would have quite a different department. But this was also part and parcel of the general growth of what, for lack of better terminology, one can call the political correctness university,
mm-hmm.
which was really brought into existence probably in the course of the 90s, certainly by the beginning of the 21st century, in which the new politically correct culture, which had been introduced partly by the radical students in the 60s, then became part of a process of tenurization, and was adopted particularly by university administration, so that the university administration of the 1990s, very, very different from the university administration of the 60s and 70s. So it's part of a very general kind of transformation of culture and politics, which transformed the entire university, particularly in the humanities and to some extent in the social sciences, and in no area more than in the administration itself.
Mm.
So by 2000, you're in quite a different situation.
Well, in some ways, perhaps it was an attempt to continue that golden period of the 60s. I mean, it was, like you said, it was a kind of, that the origin was in the 60s. And it was those people that got their degrees in those years that then went on to be tenured and to develop new approaches to history that then became their areas of expertise and their bailiwick within the university. But I suppose it goes back to that idea of politics as a kind of salvation, you know, that it is a kind of inculcation into a mindset that's meant to really have a kind of, maybe even, well, this may be extreme, but a kind of more of a transcendent approach than was traditional.
Yeah, the university is about politics. And this was what was beginning to come in by the 1990s. Although there was a lot of politics in the part of radical students in the 60s and early 70s, the university at that time was not about politics, but it became much more so by the process of cultural transformation, which then began to influence the faculty more and more, and the administration and the priorities of the university. And this was a culture of emphasis on alterity and deconstruction, the deconstruction of dominant paradigms, dominant values, dominant principles. It was a turning inside out of many aspects of university culture.
Of Western culture.
And of Western culture in general, right.
So, I'm struck that the political resonance, the reaction to political correctness is more noticeable now. It has had more resonance in this past election. It seems to be something that Fox News is always focused on. And if you do polling, the vast majority of Americans really dislike it. They don't like this limit, this idea of limiting, of having this kind of format of opinion that is correct versus a more individualistic approach, a more liberal approach, that we'd say, to ideas. And yet, in another way, it seems to me young people now are very PC in their opinions. I mean, not everyone, of course, but that in effect that it has been successful in the sense that it has had a huge impact on this next generation.
Well, these are the attitudes and values that are inculcated by the educational system, and people are naturally influenced by the system under which they've grown up.
Yes. Yeah, unfortunately, we, as humans, we're perhaps over influenced or under influenced in many cases, in terms of some people or some segments of the culture, as far as I'm concerned. But maybe we should get back to your work. So, how has your work been received in Spain? I mean, you have a specific reputation there. Are you identified with a particular approach to historical research? I mean, you're saying that things became politicized here, but I assume that was very much the case in Spain, in terms of, especially after Franco left the scene, that the reaction to Franco would then have elicited a kind of well, PC approach in Spanish educational circles. What have your experiences been like in that area?
Well, the situation, of course, has changed considerably over the years. My first two books about Spanish affairs dealt with institutions of the right, the Falange and the politics of the military, and were critical of the right, and were broadly very well received, and very well received by left-wing commentary, because this was more or less the sort of thing that left-wing commentary wanted to see done on Spanish affairs.
In Spain also, it was. I'm talking really more about
Spain.
Well,
in Spain, of course, you had, until 1966, a situation of censorship, so that
yes.
I was not able to publish a book in Spain until 1972. Spain changed a good deal in that regard in the late 60s and 70s, in which it developed considerable freedom of expression, as long as certain no-go zones were respected, that is, no personal criticism of Franco, but you could even criticize aspects of the regime, so long as these were presented as technical or objective discussion of policies and institutions and not of Franco's leadership itself. So that the country changed a great deal during the 1960s. But when I was brought in the project on revolutions in the modern world, in the latter part of that decade, before I left UCLA, I was given what was a surprisingly large advance to write a book on the Spanish Revolution. Now, I had not had any such ambition, but it seemed to me a very logical and good idea to work on the left and on the Spanish Revolution of the Republican Civil War period. So I accepted the hefty advance and set to work. And the fact that we were able to bring in the Southworth collection at San Diego after I had nominated the Hispanist to be the founding chair of the San Diego History Department, meant that we even had a good collection of research materials in Southern California, and of course also the Hoover Institution. So I did much of my research for the book on the Spanish Republic in California. But when I found, really to my surprise, because I had accepted the standard interpretation of things, that the Spanish left was basically democratic and supporting democratic institutions, though with some tendency toward radicalization, this was not the case, that in fact the initial subversion of Republican institutions was carried out by the revolutionary left and not by the right, and simply pointed this out clearly and firmly in the book, as well as developed the history of the revolutionary process during the Civil War period, this did not make the left happy at all. And they said, I had changed. Well, I had not changed at all. I was applying the same principles and the same methodology to the left that I had used on the right. But what was critical of one also was equally critical of the other. Mm-hmm. And that was not received very well at all in some circles. So that in democratic Spain, there has been more and more division of historical opinion according to political tendencies. Mm-hmm. And what has become politically correct in Spain is to maintain the myth of the Republic. This was a virtuous democratic experiment supported by the left and irrationally subverted and suppressed by the right. And so this is absolutely de rigueur in Spanish university circles, which, except for the Catholic universities, have almost totally taken over the university systems, so that in their own way, Spanish universities are just as politically correct as American universities. You can say, in some respects, almost more so. It's typical of the Spaniards that they don't play any very active political role part of the time. They behave much of the time as very normal and even conformist people, but when they become mobilized for some particular point of view, they tend to carry it to extremes. So a Spanish characteristic is a certain periodical extremism. And one finds probably extremes of political correctness in the last 10 years in Spain that go beyond anything seen in the United States or even in some other parts of Western Europe. So that there is a strong barrage of critical opinion of my work on the part of the dominant established academic left in Spain. And that has grown even stronger during the later 20th century as I've done more work on the Republican period. The climate which seemed so very favorable in the 1960s and 70s has become very hostile in recent mm-hmm. years because of this politicization. I am considered a conservative scholar in Spain. That is, a conservative scholar is someone who does not espouse leftist points of view, but tries to recount objective history according to an empirical methodology and procedure. So I have many strong supporters there, but also a great many critics. And in the closed world of the politically correct university, I am not well received.
Let's stop.
The political correctness is by far the most important because it has no canonical definition. Liberalism had canonical definitions. So did socialism, communism.
What about fascism?
Fascism is closest in that it had a definition according to individual movements. But fascism did not have the kind of hard and fast doctrine you could find in a number of other movements. Even anarchism had a more clear-cut doctrine, perhaps, than fascism did, so that the principles of fascism had to be understood by praxis, by the values and the policies that were affirmed and expressed, rather than what were laid out in abstract philosophies.
So it was it was more of behavior in terms of. It seems to me that there's it's the actual practice, yeah, that defines it, you know, that it has, yeah. But what about with fascism? Would you say like racism maybe would have been a connecting ideology of all fascist movements?
And prior to 1938, Italian fascism did not have a particular kind of racist or racial ideology.
But they kind of
took a racist attitude toward people in East Africa. That was the standard racist attitude of everybody.
Right.
It was not a uniquely fascist attitude.
Yeah.
And fascism, of course, had not been initially anti-Jewish at all. That was a change when Mussolini became wanted to become more of a parallel to Hitler in 1938. So you can't even say that fascists are all anti-Semitic. This
right.
is often said,
right.
but some fascists have not. Mussert, the leader of the Dutch National Socialist Movement, said that all Dutch Jews who felt themselves a loyal and patriotic Dutchman and who were willing to affirm such principles were welcomed in the movement.
I guess maybe what I meant by that there always is an there is an the other or some entity that you are focused on eliminating or destroying or moderating or segregating, but perhaps that's true of all politics, and perhaps you know that's something that's embedded in political life.
Well, that's true of all radical politics.
Yeah,
that's probably not true of all politics. So the fascists, of course, had their philosophical principles, which they expressed up to a point. The Italians probably more than anyone else, in terms of philosophy, though not in a completely unified way. And of course, this was George's discovery and his insistence in the 1960s that fascism was ideologically coherent in that it had a set of values and principles that could be explained and affirmed, even though they had not all been necessarily canonically stated very clearly sometimes by the fascists themselves. They had an ideology and they were committed to it. You know, this is a breakthrough point for George in the analysis of fascism, which he affirmed very effectively, initially to great skepticism on the part of his professorial interlocutors at Stanford in 1964, because some very eminent scholars did not believe that and did not agree with him at that point. Political correctness is really absolutely amorphous. It doesn't, I mean, it has doctrinal statements about specific points, that's all. It doesn't have any central leadership. It is the leadership of the progressive elite of Western institutions. Mm-hmm. So it's a very amorphous kind of a leadership. It's organized in certain political parties, certainly the Socialist Party in Spain, the Social Democratic parties in Europe, the Democrats more and more in the United States, and yet they are not parties that are themselves organized officially around doctrines of political correctness. Mm-hmm. They're organized officially around older doctrines that stem from older political philosophies, and they have adopted this, but they have not enshrined. Yeah, Obama was a very politically correct president, but operated within the traditional Democrat Party, and he did not establish a canon of political correctness.
He operated within the Democratic Party, but he didn't do anything to really support or sustain the party. In fact, the party shrunk radically during his tenure as president. So, I mean, that was a case of somebody who did have a kind of political, political approach that didn't have any kind of connection with the realities of politics, in a sense. The down and dirty part of politics, it seems to me, that's my own opinion, but he always seemed to be floating above, you know, that kind of hectoring approach to people that they aren't living up to his standards has resonance with what you're talking about.
Obama played a kind of messianic role, but he just didn't get involved in the nitty-gritty of politics. It was the politics of the leader. surprising how the fact that in some respects the Democrat Party was weaker by 2016 than it had been in 2008, but one had not been expecting that because
yes.
he had such a good electoral organization
he
in
did.
2012. One did not realize that this was not being transferred over to the party itself.
I mean, many people explain that as racism, but I think to some extent, it was certainly that's true. But it also was, I think, a level of political incompetence and naivete that has to be acknowledged, and also perhaps self-referential thinking on the part of these elites, that they get into these self-referential tropes, as
well,
George
that's
said.
That's a phenomenon, of course, of charismatic politics.
Yeah.
And Obama obviously very much played on the politics of charisma. And you find other examples of charismatic figures who can't transfer this kind of support that they generate emotionally among large numbers of people into something that's systematic and sustained.
Yes. Well, we should perhaps discuss your teaching career. But after all, that's what you did for most of your life, was teach and write. So did you enjoy teaching? You taught many, many years the course on World War II, which was always a popular course. You taught generations of undergraduates, and what were your impressions of the students at Wisconsin and your experiences as a teacher?
Well, my experiences with the undergraduates were always enjoyable and positive ones. I was not as much dedicated to certain kinds of undergraduate teaching as some people were, and of course the way we taught in those days is a good deal more simple than in the 21st century. We didn't use all the kinds of teaching aids and visual devices and electronic forms that are employed in the classroom nowadays. It was a much more simple kind of thing. The way that George and I taught was basically the classic lecture course using the blackboard. And I didn't get into other kinds of things until I first developed the World War II course, when I saw that there were, of course, a lot of documentary materials that could be employed in the course. And in fact, the first time I taught it, I used too many. I hardly left enough time for the basic classroom instruction. But I became used to teaching the basic courses, the survey courses during the early years. And I didn't particularly enjoy teaching the survey courses because one has to teach in such a thin way. It's necessary for one to dramatize certain things in order to really get the students' attention and to be able to convey some kind of understanding of some important things. The kind of teaching that I prefer to do is more empirical. George was the ideal kind of survey course teacher, and he made a big reputation for himself in his early years. I did not enjoy teaching the survey courses as much. I enjoyed teaching more the upper class courses, and more, in fact, as time went on, I did that sort of thing.
Almost like an undergraduate seminar approach.
The undergraduate seminar became a main feature of the Wisconsin program, particularly as we maintained the requirement that all graduating history teachers have at least one semester of undergrad seminar, and as the graduate enrollments declined, so that one found that more and more the only kind of seminar course that could be taught by most of the faculty any given semester was the undergraduate seminar. So there would be twice as many or three times as many undergrad seminars as there would be graduate seminars in any given term. And so that became a special feature of the Wisconsin curriculum in history by the latter part of the 20th century. I enjoyed particularly the course on Europe between the wars. It was my favorite course, the Greek conflict period of European history, and I taught that many times. Later on, I didn't much the undergraduate courses on Spain, particularly the earlier course, because that always attracted a lower enrollment, and I didn't think it was important to teach that on the undergraduate level, as to teach the more significant courses dealing with broader European history. And I did redesign in my later years the course on World War II, and I think I did a good, very good job on it, finally, when I redesigned it, whereas I did not do a good job when I first introduced that course, or reintroduced it, as early as 1972. The problem there was that the undergraduate enrollments had fallen off a cliff, and in the courses in French and Spanish history, we're getting low enrollments of 25 students, enough to make them qualify as legitimate courses. No problem about that. There's never a need to cancel that kind of course when you offered it, but compared to the enrollments we've been getting before and the need to support our graduate students, we had to find more undergraduate enrollment. And so I revived the World War II course.
Which is a subject that does gain attention from the students. It's still a big course in terms of attracting undergraduates, yes.
But I don't think I did a very good job of teaching it the first couple of times I taught it. And then I got away from that, teaching other things for a number of years, and only came back to it consistently in the very last years of my teaching life, between 2001 in 2005, when I taught it every spring semester for 4 years. And then I completely reorganized the course and prepared a new set of lectures, though these lectures could not be given more than, say, 4 times. I think that this course, using fewer audiovisuals, although using still the very best ones that were available, and then with much more adroitly designed lectures, then turned it into quite a good World War II course. And I was very pleased with that course, the way it ended up in the final years.
So you did a course on University of the Air, if I recall, that there are tapes of that course. Do you recall doing a taped University of the Air lecture series?
Yes.
Was that in the 70s? Or?
That was done, yes, possibly as early as the late 70s, no later than 1980. And what they did simply was to tape my lectures in the Europe Between the Wars course, and then broadcast it as a University of the Air lecture series. That was the course that I taught more frequently than any other course.
Okay. That would be something that we should find those tapes and reformat them. I think that would be very interesting to see. I mean, I assume you think they hold up.
Well, they would,
yeah, they're probably quite good, actually.
I would revise them, I'm sure.
Yeah,
right. Now, both in terms of style and also in terms of content at some points, but I think they're probably still relatively valid.
Okay, well, we'll have to see if we can find those and listen to them. It'd be very, very interesting. So you found the students accessible, interested? I mean, that there are always a range of students, of course, at big public universities, well, at all universities, but you probably had some good students that came through and on the undergraduate level. But then let's talk also a bit about your role as a graduate trainer.
Well, the undergraduate students you find normally are simply nice kids.
Yeah.
And so they tend to win your sympathy, even though you're not impressed by the academic performance of a good many of the individuals involved.
Yeah.
And so that, the undergraduate students at Wisconsin certainly have their faults and their flaws, but they tend to be sympathetic people, and one wanted to try to instruct them, to help them the best one could, and I always tried to be understanding of any sort of special needs or the ones that they had. You are teaching large numbers. I mean, normally I would be teaching lecture courses that had teaching assistants, and so I would not be teaching small sections of undergraduate students. The small sections of undergraduate students would come only in the undergrad seminars. And in the undergrad seminars, of course, I always endeavored to make the students write, to develop their writing, and to criticize their writing, because you only learn to write well if something that I tried to always build into the undergrad seminars, a fair amount of writing, and having them hand in revised papers whereby they had corrected some of the mistakes they had, or shortcomings they had on their individual drafts. I'd never had as many grad students as George did, but the total number was probably not more than 15 in the years at Wisconsin. I did have, contrary to what I had said earlier, I did have two students who began their graduate training with me at UCLA. Neither of those finished his degree after I left.
Hmm.
They both fell by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, in fact, most of the Wisconsin students who began to work with me did complete their degrees. And it was very hard in the case of several of them who got their degrees in the 70s to get academic jobs and had to go into other fields. The majority of them were able to have academic careers of one kind or another. And almost everybody, with one exception, managed to publish his dissertation. And
that's great.
A high rate of dissertation publication of the Wisconsin students.
Mm-hmm. So, and what proportion, off the top of your head, do you think did go on to academic careers? Was it the majority, or? I know a couple of them are in, even now, in good positions.
In history, the majority of grad students want to become academics because it does not absolutely prepare you for anything else other than that, although it can be used for other things, and you can go into other fields successfully, as a good many people have.
More and more so, it seems, that people with doctorates in history go into government, they go into the security state, business. It seems like there's more and more opportunities outside of academic life.
But a PhD is an expensive degree.
Yes.
And it's usually not worth the effort to put it all into an academic degree, to go all the way to completing a doctorate, if you're not planning to have an academic career, because you can have these other careers usually without completing a PhD degree.
And you don't give up 10 years of your prime money-making life to study. But, you know, that seems more like it's almost a calling in a way, it seems, for a number of the students that I know in recent years anyway. But then also, it's now, you know, we have a fully funded program. So, I suppose if you balance it out and say, you know, you're giving up some of your main money-making years for extended period of study. On the other hand, you're paid, not well, but now you're not paying tuition anymore. You're not paying, you know, in the way that you used to have to pay. So I don't know. I guess it is, it probably is, if you're looking at just in terms of economics, it probably doesn't make a lot of sense. It probably never did. But, you know, I think people go into history for all kinds of reasons besides the potential of making money.
Well, of course, I was a very fortunate person because my timing was so good, I went
yes.
in at exactly the right time. And certainly I never suffered economically. I believe I had believed that I would be able to make a living as an academic, but I didn't expect to make relatively as good a living as I did.
Well, that was, I mean, it sounds like you're a bit like your father. You always were a very hard worker. I mean, you always really have devoted yourself to intense engagement in history, in research, and in teaching. And I think that might be the reason that you were successful as you were.
Well, as you say, it is a calling.
Yeah.
And I think it is for most people who do PhDs in history, because they don't assume this is the way that they're going to maximize their income. They really want to do that.
Right.
So least 50% of them have had academic careers. Some have had to go into other things. I had several finishing their degrees in Wisconsin in the 70s who simply had to go into other lines of work. One of them became a librarian in the city of Napa, the head of the Napa City Library.
Not so bad.
Became his main career eventually. Then later on in the 80s, but it was a little easier to get an academic life. One of my best students was Colin Winston, who was a Madison boy, did a summer internship the year before he finished his degree with the CIA, and they offered him a very good position with some seniority and salary, better salary than he could get in the academic world, moving in at a more of an intermediate level of the CIA. And so he's had his career in the government intelligence agency. You know, the various people like that, but at least it has been gratifying that, that a certain proportion of them have been able to develop academic careers.
Well, perhaps we should finish up and just discuss George as a teacher once more. And it seemed that his approach to teaching was teaching as provocation. I mean, and I'm wondering whether, I mean, he felt that you had to somehow break through the incrustations of ideology that students came in with. I mean, I do think that he had a kind of sense of a calling to do that, mm-hmm. That he felt like he needed to really confront, provoke students in a way that probably isn't possible now, because you would feel, I mean, maybe he would have learned other ways of doing it, but his style of teaching probably would not resonate anymore.
No. There would be a reaction on the part of some that he was making them uncomfortable and
yes.
making them feel unsafe.
Yes, I would think so.
And George already saying in the last years of his life, about 96, 97, that it's a good thing that he was retired, because he just couldn't teach anymore in the contemporary university. He was he didn't know how to be politically correct, and his whole style was to be more or less politically incorrect.
Yes.
In teaching.
Yes, that's right.
And,
was,
of course, the old university was up to a point tolerant, and therefore you could be politically incorrect and still be operating within the standard university mores. Nowadays, there is much more emphasis upon conformity to political correctness, and if you are politically correct according to the mores of the 21st century, of course, this simply is not going to be tolerated.
But you wonder in a way whether, given the political climate in Wisconsin now, whether someone like, say, Harvey Goldberg or George or some of those other very provocative figures would really be allowed to teach in the way they did in the current academic and political scene. Both from both sides, you know.
No, no, no. To challenge the dominant university mores the way that people like George and Harvey and some others did, this would not be permitted nowadays.
Yeah, it's very different. It's a very different atmosphere. The one person that I think had a kind of charismatic, provocative approach in recent years was Don Downs. I don't know if you ever went, and he had a kind of Pied Piper following that would, you know, they would subversively skewer the PCU administration in various ways. When that Don, to some extent, perhaps would orchestrate in terms of
you're absolutely right.
Yeah,
he had this. And I think that Don's style was less provocative.
Well, you know, I took one of his courses, and I thought that he was quite provocative in the and I think he actually agrees with me on this because I've talked to him about it. He was really very aggressive in attacking the Clintons, for example, in attacking the university administration. I mean, he was really out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
well, I've never seen Don in a classroom.
Yeah,
so,
he's great.
You know more about this than I do.
Very provocative. Yeah. But anyways, well, perhaps we should wrap it up here, and if we'd like to continue, we can. If we come up with some more scintillating topics. But thank you so much, Stan. This was
very
great.
Welcome. You're welcome.